And Arnie Sherman.
You're listening to What Do You Know on News Talk KGVO, AM 1290 and 98.3 FM. Arnie Sherman, a good Sunday morning.
You know, this is going to be our last show of the year. 2021 has flown by, Scott. We've had a lot of interesting guests, and we're going to start the year with someone that that we had on, you know, maybe a year, 15 months ago, Tino Sonora, Dr. Robert Sonora, who's a economist and a research professor and has been studying COVID and the effect of COVID on employment and the economy. And he's always good to talk to. Even when I run into him, you know, casually, he always has interesting things to say. And, you know, we have a lot of burning issues like inflation and supply chain issues and great resignation and real estate prices and all these things that are floating around that affects our listeners every single day. I'm going to try to get maybe, you know, a more, right, you know, impartial perspective on that from an economist.
Arnie, we are back with our guest, Robert Tino Sonora.
Tino, it's so good to have you back on the show. It's great to see you. We can see Tino because we're Zooming this, but for those of you that can't see it, Tino is resplendent in his new, I guess, COVID-produced beard, and he looks very professorial. So I have many questions for you now that you have this new serious look about yourself.
Hopefully my answers will justify my looks, and good to see you guys as well. It's been a while. I'm trying to think the last time I actually talked to you guys. I think it was on Zoom, but I don't remember exactly.
It was
a little over a year ago.
Wow. Well, that's a good segue. It's a little over a year ago, and we're ending up now 2021, heading into 2022, and there are all these issues, you know, floating around that's going to carry over. We've been dealing, obviously, with the lingering effects of the COVID pandemic and the mutations. We got inflation on our hands now. We got supply chain issues. We got the great resignation happening, not only in Montana, but around the country. We got soaring real estate prices. We got a new infrastructure bill, you know, that's just been passed and, you know, under the, you know, Build Back Better plan that will have some effects, obviously, on Montana, you know, and then we're locally, you know, in a situation where while the, you know, inflation in the United States is growing, we have, you know, a situation in Montana where the unemployment rate is down. So I think statewide, what is it, Tino? 3.1% statewide in Missoula, 1.9%. I mean, we haven't never seen numbers like this. So,
yeah, I think a lot of it has to do with, you know, you mentioned the great resignation earlier. So a lot of it has to do with just labor, what we call labor force participation rate, which is essentially the number of people who are, you know, in the civilian population. So this is individuals who are not in the military, or not incarcerated or not in hospitals, who are actually participating in labor force. That is either looking for a job or are working. And again, that's kind of a minimal level. I think the actual threshold is 15 hours per week. So if you're working 15 hours per week or looking for a job, then you're part of the labor force. And that's still kind of low historically. It's about 4 or 5 percentage points below where it was prior to the pandemic. It's kind of bounced back somewhat, but just like during the Great Resignation, that labor force participation rate really kind of stagnated for a number of years during that crisis. This one, it's bounced back a lot faster, but it's still a little bit low. And I think you do see some differences in that labor force participation rate across gender. So male labor force participation rate has been falling gradually for decades, really. And it's been sort of compensated for by an increase in women's participation. And what you're seeing now, as you might expect, is that the labor force participation rate is actually lower for women than it is for men, because, you know, there's this caretaking and childcare and these kinds of things. And I'm sure we'll talk about some of these other sort of side effects of COVID. But those are things that are pretty much driving, I think, what's going on. And so when you have a smaller labor pool and you have a smaller number of people looking for work, then yeah, necessarily you're going to have a lower unemployment rate. And so that's kind of what's going on.
Would it be fair to say, Tino, that, you know, we're seeing continuously over the last, you know, maybe half year, about 4 million people a month who are resigning their jobs and either looking for, you know, the next best thing, or in the case, as you mentioned, of some women, you know, maybe being forced to stay home and take care of their kids because the school issues, or even more importantly, daycare issues. So this is something we haven't seen in, you know, in forever.
No, we haven't seen it forever. And, you know, if we were able to wind back time, you know, to 1960s or 50s, obviously when labor force participation amongst women was a lot lower, obviously these kinds of issues wouldn't rise. And it's only been that sort of gradual, well, that pretty stark increase in women's participation rates beginning in the 1970s, through, you know, till today. That's sort of, again, as I said, compensated for some of that male, thing. But yeah, we haven't seen anything. If you're under 40, you've never seen anything like this. I mean, well, we haven't seen anything like this at all since 1919, really. Wow. And so things are a lot different. It's a little bit crazy. And the way our system is kind of set up is kind of, I don't want to say sort of, set this up, in a way did set it up. And I'll talk about that a little bit later, I think. But, suffice to say that, yeah, we haven't seen anything like this is extraordinary.
And locally here in Missoula, what you see, what the manifestation of it is, you see signs up $17 an hour to go work at, you know, Wendy's or places not opening that used to be open for breakfast, you know, in the service jobs not opening to lunchtime. Some restaurants, only the drive-thrus are open, you can't go in anymore. I was in a retail establishment just the other day. And I was waiting to do something, and they said the manager had to finish cleaning up, some debris in the aisle before I could go in. You know, that's something I've never heard out of a clerk's mouth. He kind of was smiling when he said it, but the manager had to go do that because they're experiencing labor shortages. How much longer are we going to see this?
Well, who knows? I mean, obviously, the pandemic is still going on. We've got the Omicron to worry about. A lot of people are not returning to the labor force because they're scared of getting jobs, or maybe the jobs that were there are, you know, as you said, kind of like working part time because of COVID. And this Omicron thing is kind of throwing another wrench in our works. And so that, you know, this is a big unknown. I think there's fewer unknowns than we had, say, a year ago or a year and a half ago. But there's still quite a large number of unknowns that are still out there. And they're, you know, people's perceptions of what is what they can and cannot do has changed. I think, you know, more of us have become much more open, and, you know, maybe we were overly cautious, you know, a year and a half ago, and now we're maybe too, you know, not cautious enough today. And certainly there's disparities across places like Missoula, where people tend to be a little bit more risk averse than other, say, parts of Montana, which are more rural and tend to be not risk averse at all, according with respect to COVID. So you're going to see a lot of these really big differences across regions. And, you know, when you were talking about the low unemployment rate, I remember when I lived in Ohio and I was in graduate school in Columbus, and unemployment rate in Columbus hit something like 1.5%. And this was in the mid 1990s, and places like, Safeway or Kroger or whatever, they were offering $500 signing bonuses to bag groceries back then.
Right.
That's not adjusted for inflation. So, you know, that might translate to about $1,000 to $1,500 today.
Sure.
You know, so that was the time where I remember, that things got pretty tight then, but for different reasons. That was a super really strong, demand side labor market.
Right.
Now what we're experiencing is kind of a very, very weak supply side labor market.
Right.
So people are, taking themselves out of the labor force. And that's what's causing wages to be increased. You know, and I think some people, you know, anecdotally in surveys, people are just kind of fed up with being paid poorly and doing not really nice jobs, you know.
It has nothing to do with, you know, public assistance and public aid. I mean, there are two things that are going on. On the lower level, you know, the service jobs, there's frankly some tie into immigration. A lot of these entry level jobs I was just reminded by seeing West Side Story. I saw the new remake of it. And here are the Puerto Ricans, you know, starting out sweeping stores and doing those jobs, even though they're right. overqualified. A lot of the service jobs were filled by, you know, migrants and immigrants. And, you know, we had a 4-year period before Biden of really cracking down on immigration. And in some places in the country, you can see the effect of that. You don't have people working in, you know, in the service industry.
Right,
but
right.
we're also seeing it in some of the skilled professions. I just heard somebody from the Montana's Nursing Association say we're down 40, in some places, 60% vacancy rates in hospitals for healthcare workers. That's astounding to me.
It is astounding. It's a huge decline. And again, I think, you know, from that, from those perspective, from the healthcare sector, you know, people are just exhausted. And there's another concern that there's going to be another spike and that we're going to overtax our ICUs and our hospitals again going into November. And I think just people are tired. What's kind of interesting though, as you talk about wages, is that, you have these sort of rent-a-nurses. They're the traveling nurses that go around the country, right? And sort of like mercenary nurses, I guess. And
right.
you know, they didn't pay twice of what the nurses in the hospitals that are there are getting paid. I don't know what that exact number is. And, you know, you're going to start, you know, that's going to start beating on itself, you know, and maybe
sure.
people will say, well, why would I work at this hospital for X amount of dollars when that person's coming in and working twice as much, say, maybe I'll do the exact same thing and go to, I don't know, to Tennessee or Kentucky, right? Kentucky just
right.
we're going to have some crises going on now. And it's a really interesting, you know, it's a really interesting time to be an economist. And there's not many times I kind of joke about this, that economists get to be really sexy, but this is one of those times. People don't want to listen to us until things get really difficult.
Sure.
But here we are. it's really interesting time.
And you understand the layered effect of something like COVID. Even if, for example, the Omicron variant doesn't kill a lot of people, you know, there's some evidence that at least at this time of recording,
so far, yeah,
that
yeah.
you get sick, but you're not going to die as much. And maybe it's affecting a younger group and blah, blah. But you're still going to have a lot of people sick.
Oh, yeah.
You know, millions of people sick. And what effect does that have on the workforce and on supply chain delivery and, you know, on service? You know, I think about mail service and FedEx and, you know, delivery, you know, truckers across the country. You get sick, you're not going to be driving anywhere if you have a fever and, you know, you're weak.
Right. Exactly right. And I think what's not being discussed, I mean, that's sort of like contemporaneous effects of this shock.
Sure.
But I think what's not also being discussed is sort of the longer term implications for the economy of a shock like this. The recent study that came out, Santa Clara University or Santa Barbara University or somewhere over in the Cal system mentioned that 25% of people that got sick with COVID will have long COVID. Now, what are the long term impacts of 25%? Let's say 25% of the workforce now has long-term COVID. Are they going to be sporadically leaving the workforce because of this over time? You also think about training today. If people are leaving their jobs today, what skills are they going to lose? Now, granted, some people are going to retool, right, reskill, and actually accumulate skills, but there's still going to be some people that aren't. And so, you know, I don't think we're really discussing the longer-term implications as much as perhaps we think. And you know, as a macroeconomist, that's kind of how I tend to think of things in terms of longer term implications and economic growth down the road. And I think that that's another thing we have to factor in. And I mean, it's with the childcare, it's with the health, it's with all these things.
It's just a big
Yeah, it's a mess. It's going to be a mess.
I know two people who have quit. I know two people who have quit their jobs because right. other people have gotten sick in their company. Their workload has doubled or tripled.
Oh,
they're not getting a significant pay increase, you know, in the short term. And they're saying, I'm not going to do this.
Right.
You know, this is crazy. You know, maybe didn't love the place to begin with. And,
right.
you know,
right.
with all the, you know, with all the other kind of job openings, you know, and now's the time when employers want to make sure they don't lose people because they're going to be hard to replace.
Very difficult.
Yeah. Oh, sorry, Scott.
No, I was going to ask a related question, which is, are there any sectors of the economy where you're starting to see some level of, you know, pre-pandemic levels in terms of, you know, vitality, if you will, and use?
Yeah.
Like, 'cause I had seen something yesterday about the dine-in For restaurants, we're kind of like almost close to pre-pandemic levels of people dining out, which I was surprised to see that. Is there anything else like that?
What bounced back really fast too is manufacturing, which also bounced back pretty quickly. And then you have some sectors that obviously didn't really go into any kind of decline, you know, when we talk
like
about
real estate
or banking or, you know, delivery drivers and these kinds of things. I mean, where especially delivery drivers and anybody that's in the supply chain will really have, you know, probably didn't lose too much unless they were sick. But, you know, in terms of like a great resignation kind of idea, I don't see it. And most people are now finding that the great resignation is kind of limited to a small number of sectors. So that's one aspect of it. Another aspect of it is that it's called the great resignation because usually during a course of, over the time of a year or two or whatever, there are sectors that experience their own like great with a small g resignations. But right now you're just seeing it all kind of happen at once. And so it's hard to say. I haven't looked at in too much depth into the sort of micro level, which sectors are doing relatively well and which are not. You know, some of the sectors you expect would be doing well, like health, for example, obviously has not. But a lot of that is due to the fact that the structure of our health sector is that a lot of services provided by hospitals, what have you, is voluntary surgery. And so when everybody's sick and no one can take care of somebody with their gallbladder surgery, then that there goes that. So kind of ironic in the way things have kind of panned out. I was also going to mention about that your friends losing their jobs. And I was listening to something today that about inflation and these kinds of things is the way the United States handles these kinds of crises is really sort of like we go from like episode to episode. We don't have any intermediate planning going on in the meantime. And what was going on in Europe at the same time is people continue to get paid for a 40-hour work week, but maybe didn't work the full 40 hours. Maybe they only worked 20 hours and the governments were making up that difference, say that 20-hour difference. It's still paying them for 40 hours, even though they're only working 20 hours. And so there weren't these huge checks that went out in the mail that would be driving some inflation. And so inflation in Europe is running about 2 percentage points below what it is in the United States right now.
And right. For example, as you probably know, in France, there's a minimum set wage a month that every employable person gets. And that's equivalent to about $1,700 US a month, which is not horrible.
Right. It's not horrible. It's livable. And then you don't go through this sort of this burst of spending. But what I suspect is going to happen is that those COVID checks are running out. People have spent all they can on Amazon. There's only so much room in their house to put another stereo in. And so what are they going to start? Are they going to keep this momentum in buying? Or is that going to slowly die out? And certainly with higher inflation, you will start seeing the slowdown and some of those demand side effects will start to slow as well. And then we also have to remember that despite the fact that this spending bills that are coming out of Washington are multi-trillions of dollars. It's not multi-trillions of dollars that are coming out tomorrow. It's multi-trillions of dollars that are coming out over 10 to 20 year period. So it's not this sudden burst of money. It's a slow burn. And that will start, I think, is, you know, and plus we don't have the workers to do some of these jobs yet anyway.
Right.
So we don't even know what bridges and roads and pipes and, you know, Wi-Fi we're going to fix anyway.
You know, you're absolutely right about the spending issue. I popped over to our local Costco and I was going to buy my favorite crab legs until I saw they were $59 a pound. You know, and I can eat a pound of crab legs, but it's not worth $60 to me right now. I mean, that was literally, you know, 6 months ago it was 22 to 25. It fluctuated in that rate. Same thing with lobster tails.
Right.
You know, and so at the high end, you're seeing a spike. And even, you know, someone who's, you know, fairly, you know, well off is going to blink twice about, you know, buying 4 pounds of crab legs for $240.
Right.
And that's post-tax money.
Right.
And you know, and some of that's supply chain related, but some of it is just, you know, the inflationary effects of what's going on.
Right, exactly. And I think what you got to remember is that people are more sensitive to price increases than they are to the price decreases. And so, especially on things you buy on every day, right? So there's kind of like this, this little inside joke that basically consumer confidence is tied to gas prices. So if you Absolutely. Really want to understand gas, if you really want to understand consumer confidence, all you got to do is look at gas prices. Now, for the vast majority of Americans, fortunately for us, maybe in other countries, it's not quite this way, but that represents a relatively small percent of our total expenditure. And so it doesn't right. eat into our, for most Americans. Now, obviously, there's some that it's going to have a fairly large effect, obviously. And if you have to commute a long way like we do in the West, it has a much bigger effect than if we all lived in, I don't know, Providence, Rhode Island or something where you could walk everywhere.
But it does have an effect on things that have to get
on transportation. Right. And so these kinds of things, but there's a lot of prices that have also fallen. The biggest jump, everybody's kind of one of the components of the CPI, which is the most off-sided index for inflation, sort of headline news inflation rate has been used car prices. And they've risen about 40 or 60% over the past year. But I don't know about you, but I don't go buy a used car every day. And so for me, that poor part of the CPI has zero impact on my spending.
Right.
And then you like your crab legs, but if you only buy them once a week, once a month, then that might not have such a huge impact on your overall spending. At the same time, you see other prices which are actually falling, but people are not sensitive to that. You know, I used to have this argument with my uncle, and he's like, well, you know, oil prices go up, gas prices go up, and then when oil prices go down, gas prices stay up. I'm like, no, they don't. And here, I'll show you the data. You can see the data. Here's
no,
the
they don't.
And it's one for one. It's basically, it goes up, it goes up, it goes down, it goes down. But that's part of people's perceptions. And so we just have to be mindful of that. I'm not saying that it's great. You know, I obviously inflation is not a good thing. And we certainly don't want, we're more concerned about long, persistent spikes that are unexpected spikes in inflation. But inflationary expectations are not that high right now. If you look at sort of 5 year out, they're hovering in the 2.5%. So markets seem to think that inflation will be under control. I don't want to say, you know, we keep seeing the word transitory, and the joke amongst economists is like, well, how long is transitory? It's like, well, I don't know. I don't know how long it is, but it's as long as it's not permanent, you know. So that's how we sort of think of things. But I think, you know, this time next year, I suspect if COVID goes away, this is a big if, right? There's a lot of uncertainty still out there. If we can sort of get this thing under wraps and we all have our seventh and eighth boosters, then I suspect this will start clearing itself out relatively soon in geologic time. You know,
you've done a bunch of research on COVID policy. So based on everything you've seen, is there a right policy and a wrong policy?
You know, when I look at policy, what I'm trying to understand is does that behavior that policymakers want, is that actually being followed by constituents? So if I make a policy, are my constituents actually going to conform to that policy? And what I found thus far is eventually, right? Yes. Eventually that policy is adapted by the constituents. Now, I'm not saying that the policy is actually going to help prevent COVID. That's not the point. The point is, are the policy restrictions actually implemented and internalized by constituents? And the answer is yes, eventually, but it takes about 15 months. Now, I'm looking at daily data, so I can observe people's behavior and I can observe policy behavior on a daily basis. And with that level of frequency of data, it's looking like 15 months. Even in a time when you think that people would like, okay, I could die from this. Obviously, there's a whole host of other things going on and outside of just the policy and people's policy. But it still takes quite a while for things.
Sure. I noticed that in New York City, where the vaccination rate is over 90% have been vaccinated, they've had a string now of days where there's been no COVID deaths.
Right.
You know, 8 million people. Montana has 1 million people and we're still seeing COVID deaths every day.
Yep.
So is that to you a validation of one policy versus another?
Here's the deal. So what I've also been looking at is this is kind of something that I just started recently, is trying to understand how policymakers view the health of the economy versus the health of their constituents. And
right.
Basically trying to estimate what the differences are across states. You know, and you might suspect, and you're right, according to my research, that in fact, yes, the New York quote unquote is more interested in preserving people's health than preserving the health of the economy. And that's not surprising, probably. I mean, one of the states that I looked at is Florida. And, you know, DeSantis has been sort of railing about, we got to open the economy. We got to open the economy. We got to keep opening it. Everything else is not important to us. And that's fine, right? But you might have these other repercussions. So part of the research is finding that, yes, there are differences across states. Some states are more concerned about health than other states. And again, when we go back to that long-term thing, what's going to happen over time? Is a state that's relatively open today going to be slower growth in 10 years because of the longer-term effects of COVID on the population? That's an empirical question that we won't be able to answer for 10 years, but at least that's something that we want to start thinking about, I think, as we move forward, is what are these sort of longer-term implications? Will that really slow education systems down eventually? Will they have to keep closing the schools down? This is something that we don't know. But it's something that I think should be discussed a little bit, at least, is as I said, those longer term implications.
Well, it seems to me that, you know, from a global perspective, I mean, you can cut this pie a million different ways, you know, right, Tino? But it seems to me that the U.S. is willing to accept a higher casualty rate from this in order to keep the economy churning than most of the other countries in the world. We have one of the highest, I think we have the third highest COVID death rate, you know, only India, Brazil, and I think maybe one other, maybe we're third or fourth.
Russia.
I'm saying we're up among, you know, the highest. And for some reason, it seems that we're willing to have a muddled policy that allows that to happen. And, I'm not sure how that all plays itself out over time.
Well, I think a couple things I'd like to say. First is, I spent a lot of time in Croatia. And if you look at Croatia's response initially, Croatia's response was, we are shutting everything down. I mean, they went like all in with shutdowns and all this kind of, but what does that do? What longer term impact does that have? You know, when they start loosening restrictions, what do you start doing? Well, people go berserk. So, right. So people are going out. And so if you sort of fast forward from, I don't know, say March of last year to say September of this year, people are going nuts because maybe that shutdown was so extreme that people just needed to release. So that's one of the things you don't want to. So part of what you have to kind of think about is, do you really want to overcook it in a sense? Because you might actually end up causing bigger problems down the road. And now Croatia's caseloads and death rates are rising fairly quickly. Another thing you have to think about is, it's hard. Okay, so we'll start with the United States. The United States is 50 different countries. We got 50 different governors, 50 different, and plus our territory. So you've got 50 different policies in place. And in some policies, as I mentioned earlier, take Florida, for example. I mean, they were much more lenient with respect to restrictions compared to, say, New York. And so you're going to see different death rates, different caseloads, et cetera, in places like New York than you are in, say, Florida. You also got to think about, are the deaths a function of the policy, or are the deaths a function of the underlying healthcare system? And if I think about a place like, which also experienced relatively high deaths, something like South Dakota, for example, I mean, it's a very rural area. You don't have a lot of sophisticated medical apparatus around. And so it's relatively difficult to take care of people who are really sick. Fortunately, for all of us, we've gotten better at dealing with this. We've got additional drugs that we can use. We got this new drug that could be coming out, to general public anytime now, which actually helps once you have it, if you get it within a certain time frame. And so we do have some additional, what we know is, we know a lot more than we did, and we have much more tools at our disposal now. You got to remember too, that just because, you know, in the United States, we see people that are anti-vaxxers, we see people that are not, but there's a lot of other countries that have the exact same issues, right? So
sure.
Austria, just, you know, you had massive protests about unvaccinated people can't go out and go to restaurants. Now only vaccinated people can. Then they shut the entire economy down. Same thing's happening in the Netherlands. Same thing's happening in Germany. And so all over the country, you are getting this kickback, which is why, you know, you almost don't want to overcook that policy too high.
Sure.
And that's a risk you take. I mean, are we being overly cautious when cases are rising? And are we taking on too much risk? That is, are we overly, you know, uncautious? I can't think of the opposite of cautious right now. uncautious when cases are falling. And maybe we got to figure out a better balance. And sure, that's another sort of line of research I'm working on, is how did these policy changes impact whether cases are rising or falling, if that's your indication of risk.
It seems to me, if you just put aside the politics of it all, if we just said everybody needs to get vaccinated and everybody needs to wear a mask in public for a period of time, that probably would have put us in a much better place than we are now.
If I think if you, you know, you don't ask me about, obviously asking an epidemiologist about this kind of thing, but, right, but if, I don't know, 70% of the population wore a mask in the first 3 months, we'd probably be out of this by now, right? Or whatever that time frame is. I'm just kind of making it up. But yeah, I mean, it's not, I don't think it's rocket science. But that goes back to the other thing. If people aren't necessarily going to listen to what you're saying for whatever reason, I'm not politics or your own cultural experience or your religious preferences or whatever. If you have that disconnect between what policymakers want and what people are actually willing to follow, then you're also going to have these crises. And that's what this research is kind of showing.
Sure,
that
sure.
Over the,
I mean, short, during, you know, when, you know, when they had, when they had tuberculosis as a, you know, a serious issue, and polio, there were people who didn't want to get the shots.
Right.
You know, I mean, there was some of that same kind of reaction to, you know, any kind of mass edict, you know, just a bristling and I'm not going to get it. I don't want to get it. But, you know, the government in those cases persevered and, you know, and they put a smart strategy in place, which is you get inoculated in public school or else you don't go to public school.
Right.
You know, so they were able to accomplish it, you know, by those means.
Well, and if you go back to the Spanish flu, I mean, memory serves, I can't remember exactly what state, but I want to say Portland, Oregon, basically shut down for 7 weeks. And Boston did not. And Boston had a much longer exposure, much more deaths associated with, and again, I'm not sure I'm getting those states right, deaths associated with the Spanish flu than Portland did.
Yeah.
And Portland basically got themselves up and running again relatively quickly.
So let's back away for a minute and take a more global, you know, 20,000 foot view of things. U.S. economy's GDP in the last, for 2021, looks like it's going to have grown by 5.6%, which is pretty healthy. It's better than we would have thought of at the beginning of the year, given all of this. And it seems like the projections for the coming year for GDP, gross domestic product, is about 3.8%. I'm not the economist, but those are the numbers I've seen thrown around.
Right.
To our listeners, what does that mean? How does that, you know, affect the typical, you know, person living here in Montana?
Well, I mean, part of it is obviously jobs. Hopefully you get some wage growth that goes in with that. Hopefully more leisure. I think one of the things that people are getting out of this great resignation is that they want more leisure time. But that's generally the thing. So, you know, we look at GDP as economists as kind of a measure for the overall, shall we say, abilities of people to enjoy life, right? It's sort of an indicator of welfare. And so countries with a higher GDP, and especially per capita, rather than overall levels of GDP, you know, that per capita GDP just gets you a higher quality of life. I think that, you know, we're not back to trend, we're probably 5 or 6% below where we would be had the COVID not happened. And so, you know, that's a fairly substantial, in the United States economy, that's a huge chunk. I mean, 5% of 20 trillion is a lot of trillions. It's still quite a bit of trillions. And so, you know, that's jobs that are lost. That's income that is lost. That is savings that is lost. It's going to impact us again down the road. It's people, you know, having to work longer than maybe they would have otherwise chosen to do because their savings is down or we're obviously, well, hopefully lives will start returning to normal, we can actually go out and do stuff. And I think economies which rely far more on like a tourism type of economy, like Montana does, you know, are going to benefit relatively more compared to other places which don't rely on so much. Just that travel, just bringing those dollars in has an impact on everybody's livelihood. And just, and then, there's all these ancillary things that are sort of associated with higher growth. You get, you know, lower levels of depression, fewer suicides, less alcoholism and drug abuse, et cetera, et cetera. And so those are other benefits that happen as a result of growth. There's just a lot less stress. So that's basically what I think we can look forward to. you know, this is going to be, I think this is going to be a hangover for a while. You know, you're probably the same as me. My grandparents used to, you know, we always used to hoard food because they lived through the Great Depression. And I think there's some switch that probably turned for us during this period. We don't know what it's going to be yet. But some switch definitely switched on and off, and we'll see how that affects our behavior going down the road.
Sure.
So my other hope is that you know, maybe we'll actually kind of really think about, I mean, my hope is that we'll really rethink our whole social safety net, the way things work. We go too much from crisis to crisis. We don't have that planning period in between these crises. And so we have to basically start from scratch, and we have these kind of fits and starts policy that kind of bursts, and then it gets taken away, and then it bursts again. As you mentioned earlier, when we had the unemployment insurance, and then people were worried that when the unemployment insurance was taken away, that people were not working because unemployment insurance was too high. So they took it away, and roughly 25 states took it away earlier than was planned. And it didn't have the impacts that they thought. I think in Montana, actually, you know, compared to what would have been had we not taken away, we actually ended up in a lower situation than a worse off situation than had we kept it. And that includes labor, employment, all these kinds.
Right, because most of these decisions to pull or not to pull are political ones. They're not thought through
in terms
of what the impacts are going to be. They're just a knee-jerk, you know, reaction to what's going on.
Exactly right. And I mean, you know, this is what economists refer to as the law of unintended consequences.
Right.
You impose a policy and you think it's a brilliant idea, and it just, you know, you squeeze the balloon and the balloon's going to pop out somewhere. Right. You just don't know exactly where it's going to be.
Sure.
And, you know,
you have funny consequences when you have average working people angry because we're going to tax billionaires and people in the top 1%, which most of them are never going to become, and neither are their kids, you know, and therefore they're opposing the very thing that could help them and their families out and to sort of modulate this peaking and valley period of what happens when crises occur. It's really, I understand it from a visceral perspective, but it's like putting your foot on the gas and the brake at the same time as a society. You just don't get anywhere.
No, and it's one of those things that's mystified me for decades. So I don't have an answer for that. But it, suffice to say, you know, it's a very difficult period, and you know, there's always somebody wants somebody else to blame, and
But it's ironic when you see the richest man in the world, like Elon Musk, screaming and yelling about we can't spend money on this stuff when he doesn't pay taxes, and he's, you know, he's worth more than half the country probably combined.
Right. and he's probably also benefiting from some tax breaks and subsidies to transportation
Tesla
have you.
Tesla got a big tax subsidy when they were having trouble. I mean,
And you know, but this is the same thing that happened with oil companies when oil companies got huge subsidies when the price of oil was going up. I mean, these subsidies were put in place to protect our energy infrastructure when oil prices were below, you know, the cost of producing the oil. In the cheapest place to produce oil. And then when prices started to go to $70, $80, $90, $100 a barrel, suddenly profit margins are rising. We kept those subsidies in place. And so it's kind of, you know, there is an element of corporate socialism in this country or any country really, for that matter, I should say. So that's, or some people call it corporate Keynesianism.
Right.
But that's true, you know, and there's something to be said for making sure that the businesses are there, and I agree,
Well, these terms that you just put out, terms socialism, capitalism, get thrown around by a lot of people that really don't understand what they mean.
No.
Right?
And that's why I kind of prefer corporate Keynesianism, although that's probably even fewer people understand that. So, But, you know, so what was actually trying is I'm going to throw another word out at you, which is called supply side Keynesianism. Now, usually Keynesianism is associated with the demand side. That is trying to put people's income in people's pockets, either by giving them direct money or by reducing their taxes. And then they go out and spend it. And you can do that in a couple different ways, right? You have monetary policy. You can lower the interest rates, which the Fed has done to try and ensure that people spend more. Or you can give them a job, which is sort of the fiscal side of things and, you know, or reduce their taxes. But what supply side Keynesianism is actually trying to actually help producers reduce their costs. And so that will increase, it will have the same effect. As long as you're moving that GDP to the right and up, then that's what you're looking for, whether it be on the supply side or the demand side. And what this is referred to also is called fiscal devaluation. And what this means is primarily in a country like in the Eurozone, for example, part of the reason the prices of why Germany is so competitive in the European market is that their prices, their overall price level is relatively low to other countries. And right. Part of that is because their businesses are being subsidized, which reduces their overall costs of production, which enables them to have lower prices to sell on international markets. And so it's a similar kind of idea for the United States is having this fiscal or the supply side Keynesianism or fiscal devaluation, where you're actually trying to help keep prices relatively low.
Well, it's interesting, as you point out, you know, Keynesianism, you know, Keynesian theory, which is, you know, obviously it simplified into, you know, more government services, lower taxes, you know, on the supply side, and therefore a lot of people consider it, you know,
on the demand side.
On the demand side. And then you consider it sort of a, you know, more centralized, you know, the centralized control of the economy. But I just noticed, you know, we're recording this, you know, before it airs, but we had these devastating tornadoes, you know, that, you know, just killed hundreds of people. And the very congressman who voted against government aid for Sandy Hook and these other places when it happened in their backyard are now demanding federal assistance for their community, which is just another continuous example that I don't want anybody else to have this, but when I need it, I want it.
Right. And we just had that. We, you know, there's that several that other guy, the guy from Wisconsin, what's his name?
Johnson?
Who also was, voting against the infrastructure bill and then tweeted how proud he was that they passed the infrastructure bill. So you get these. You know, I mean, obviously calling a politician of either stripe a hypocrite and a charlatan is not terribly controversial, but it's the brazenness and what I, you know, people rely, I think what's become increasingly evident to me is that increasingly they're relying on people's short memory and people just will forget.
Single issue, you know.
Or a single issue, yeah. Right. But, you know, as the what's the safe phrase, you know, a lie travels around the world 100 times before the truth gets around once.
Right.
You know, a lot of that kind of stuff's going on. And I'm sure there's some backroom dealings going on. And like the guy says, look, I got to say this to my constituents, but I would like to think that that's going on, that obviously there's some grandstanding going on with some of these guys.
Right. And you'd like to think that some people have the greater good in mind other than just, you know, their own political ambition. But, you know, lately it just seems from both extremes.
Right.
You have a lot of, you know, yelling and screaming, you know, like Shakespeare said, a lot of sound and fury signifying nothing.
All bark and no bite.
Yeah, really, exactly.
I was just looking at when we first spoke with you, Tina, it was back in August of 2020. And I'm just curious, in the last, let's say, 15 months since we last spoke to you, are there any elements or things that have happened that have surprised you from the in an economic sense or a you know, something on the macro level that you're like, we didn't see that coming, or was everything fairly predictive? Like you saw it and then, you know, you're seeing it come to fruition.
I don't think anybody saw it. You know, obviously no one saw it with a, you know, 2020. That's without a doubt. I remember telling my wife when this thing started happening, I said, look, this is going to be bad for 12 to 18 months. This is going to not be good. And so plan for 12 to 18 months. And that was based on previous pandemics. And then you think about the speed. I don't think, you know, I guess what surprised me is I've lost some of my optimism. Let's put it that way. That's what's been my surprise. I think I also am surprised. I will say this. No, I am surprised how quickly GDP bounced back. I am surprised by that. I am surprised that the supply side inflation, I mean, if you'd asked me the question 4 months ago, how long this inflationary episode last, I would have said not very long, and I don't think it's going to be that big of a deal. So I think that kind of caught a lot of economists off guard, was just how non-transitory this transitory supply side effect will be. I guess in retrospect, it seems not that counterintuitive, but I am a little surprised. I was surprised that, you know, there has been a relatively low amount of concentration put on really fixing our child and healthcare systems and the fight that's had to go into that. I had hoped that there had been a big enough spotlight on these holes and these issues, which are preventing people from working, preventing people from getting access to good healthcare. I thought, you know, maybe this would be enough of a light that people would sort of wake up and go, okay, we really do need to work on this.
Was it surprising to you that a place like Bozeman, Montana, now 15 months from then, has a median home price of $775,000?
Of course that's surprising. I mean, I'm surprised. Yeah, I'm surprised how much migration went in. It remains to be seen how long that lasts. You know, is it going to be like Lake Tahoe where there's a fire and then everybody leaves, you know, and then and who knows what's going to happen? It is surprising. I mean,
even Missoula, I think even Missoula's up to 560 or 570 or 580 or something.
It's crazy. No, I think everything about this is surprising, and everything that has happened is surprising. Everything that has not happened is also surprising, and I'm sure there's a lot of things we just don't know. I am also surprised, I guess, how much stock markets have bounced back. I'm floored by that. You know, this is
I don't know if they're right. We don't know what's going to happen in the next couple of weeks to end the year, but the Dow's up, I think, 17% for the year, and NASDAQ's up 20% for the year. That's a good return at any time in history.
It's a great return, and but on the other hand, you know, because you know, economists on the one hand, but on the other hand, if you're in the stock market, it's great.
Right.
If you're not, it's not so great, and. Right. It's just going to increase some of these wealth inequalities. I think we're seeing inequalities growing in wealth. There are going to be some income inequalities growing. There's health inequalities are growing. Education inequalities are starting to grow. And again, going back to that long-term thing, which I keep kind of harping on, that's going to have these longer-term implications and create two Americas, I think.
It's a good place for us to take a break. Our guest is Tina Sonora, Director of Healthcare Research with the University of Montana, back after this. Arnie, we are back with our guest, Tina Sonora.
So, Tino, if we're looking at 2022 as an economist, what's your headlines that you would share with our listeners? What should they pay attention to, or what should they expect?
I look forward to inflation actually relaxing. I look forward to a clearer definition of which sectors of the economy are recovering and moreover, which sectors of the economy will continue to be part of the economy and which will kind of die off. With any type of large crisis of this type, we see a lot of changes, churns in the economy. And, you know, for example, you talk about going to the restaurant. There's a lot more robots, if you will, that are taking orders, and people just bring your food, even at a sit down type of restaurant. So there's all these technological changes that are happening. So I kind of look forward to having a more well-defined idea of what the structure of our economy looks like going forward after this. There were some structural changes that happened during the financial crisis. I think this is going to have a similar type of impact. And so that's what I think I look for. And any kinds of changes that might happen in our sort of health net, you know, healthcare, childcare policies.
That's a great place to stop. Tina, we appreciate you coming on. You're a great guest.
You always have insightful things to share with us. I really appreciate it, Tina.
Thank you, guys. It's always fun to talk to you guys, and good to see you after so long.
Have a great holiday too, Tina.
You as well. Happy holidays.
See you next week, Arnie.
See you next week, Scott. Take care.
Thank you for listening to What Do You Know?
I can't wait for the next show, Scott.
I'm excited too, Arnie. If you'd like to suggest a guest, send me an email at scottrichman@townsquaremedia.com. We'll see you next week. And thanks for listening to News Talk KGVO,